Hello and welcome to another episode of On My Last Eggs. I'm Rachel, and like millions of other women worldwide, I'm navigating the wild throes of perimenopause.
It's the trusting of yourself and your own body. To hear it's only when your periods change or stop, it's only when you're a certain age, that's complete bollocks because we're all different.
I'll be lifting the lid on what that whole messy, confusing journey entails, with plenty of lols and some WTFs along the way.
Whatever ticks our box, whatever we realise we're passionate about, we create our new tribes, our new adventures. It's fantastic, and that's definitely one of the positives, yes.
I'm very pleased to welcome to On My Last Eggs this week, Aline Boblin, who is the founder of Menopause Knowledge, which is a community interest company, not for profit, helping women with everything to do with their menopause. Welcome, Aline. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you very much for having me today, Rachel. And how are you?
I'm good, thank you. I'm good, yeah. Now, you've been on my periphery, my radar, you know, my social media ever since I started this On My Last Eggs journey. And, you know, we've kind of crossed paths like that. But last weekend, I had the pleasure of seeing you in action, Aline. And that is what I want to talk about today, because you are an activist and an agitator in many ways when it comes to menopause. But, well, you know, and that's a good thing, right?
Oh, it is, yes.
I didn't have any idea of just what a fantastic, robust and rich tool you were taking out into communities. So tell me a little bit about what you're doing with Menopause Knowledge.
Well, it all started because of my own journey. So it's like most of us on the circuit. It's not purely because we have an interest in supporting women. It's because I derailed myself. I had 10 years of misdiagnosis. And you know, before we met, I thought, oh, I'll try and remember everything. And the list is just ridiculous of those 10 years. And I think what happened to me, it shouldn't happen to anybody else. It was completely unnecessary. Menopause is something that is a natural process. The challenges that we face in peri and in post-menopause, we should have a lot more information and support to prevent them affecting us negatively. And that is the main motivation. The way it started was a little bit before the pandemic, more and more friends were chatting with me about, oh, my, you know, my GP says this, my GP says that. And I started having chats with them that became virtual because of COVID. And then I was bored because I'd lost my job thanks to the menopause fairy. And that's when I created a CIC with three other fantastic women who support me in the background. And then it just grew. It grew from a few slides to referencing a few people to what you saw.
Yes.
And you keep growing.
So it was a two-hour kind of talk come workshop. And actually, you struggled to fit everything into that 2 hours. I think you're going to have to start making it a whole day, Aline, really.
Yes, yes.
And from the point of tools and resources, I was blown away. Basically, the women get a handout, which is 115 pages long, and it's full of QR codes. So if there's an element in that handout that really speaks to you, you know, a particular symptom or a particular problem or a particular area you think you need help with, you can scan the QR code and then go deeper in, you know, to get the right help for you. I mean, I'm impressed. I hate technology and presentations and everything. So as someone who hates all of that, I'm like, oh my God, Aline might be some kind of superhero. I don't know how she's done that. So you go through this presentation and you talk about all sorts of things, the things you'd expect, the symptom checker, you know, and there's some little quizzes. Which of these hormones do you think we lose during, you know, menopause and stuff like that? And then that's 115 pages, but also you've got other handouts that dip into other things, menopause and neurodiversity, for instance, which we'll come back to because I think it's a really fascinating topic. How long have you been actually doing these face-to-face presentations with groups of women? And in the one I was at, I think there was 15 or 16 of us there.
Yes,
I think.
There was about 17 of us. Yeah, so it was not a very large one. The largest we've had has been around 50, 55. Mm-hmm. Initially, there wasn't that much. And initially, it was really chatting. But then when you speak to women, you also have women who want pictures, or they prefer a graph, or they want to see it on the screen, or they want to look for themselves, or they just want to hear you. And I really thought long and hard, what would have worked for me, but what would work for each person individually, depending on their own preferences? Because a little bit like menopause, there's no one size fits all or one unique menopause. We each have our menopause, our unique menopause fingerprint, really. Similarly, the content has to be delivered in a way that's going to speak to each person individually. What you saw last week, it was the first time I included so much of a quiz, because we always get feedback at the end. And some of the feedback there is quite consistently, we would like more opportunities to talk. By asking the questions in a quiz fashion, then it leads people to talk.
And as people start to put their hands up to answer things or speak out, then you start to see other people in the room as well, that you go, oh, I think you've got the similar thing to me. And then you have the tea break, and then everyone chats.
And then everyone chats. And that's also why I organize the rooms the way I do, which is more of a sort of wedding suite, where it's four or five chairs in a semicircle on a smaller table. So people get talking with their cups of tea, with their bits of paper. Mm. And this way they create their own community and their own support.
The other thing you had was you had this table of books that people could come and look at. And I helped you set that table up. So I was putting the books out, and I was thinking, you know, they were there for people maybe in the break.
Oh, yeah.
But you used them like props. And it was like you knew exactly what book. So you'd be talking about, I don't know, vaginal dryness. And you'd go, and so, you know, another thing you might be suffering from is this. And then whip up, you know, Jane's book, My Menopausal Vagina. And then you'd be talking about eating and how changing your nutrition could help, and whip up another book.
Jessie's,
and yes. It was so good, honestly. If anyone gets the chance to go on one of Aline's talks, you absolutely should. And the menopause knowledge, go and find her and follow her on social media.
Now, something quite important for people who listen to know is I don't pretend to be an expert in terms of a medical expert. I'm an expert by experience, which is quite different. And it's critical for me to share that what I talk about, I've researched. It's not Mrs. or Mr. Google who've given me the answers. It's coming from what I have read that I have sourced as being evidence-based, because it's really a challenging arena at the moment, where menopause has become this cash cow and there's all these miracle cures. And if you do those four steps, I was looking at TikTok this morning, those five steps will mean you will lose all your belly fat. I'm like, well, how much money have we spent by the time we've bought the liquid collagen, the very specific magnesium, and God knows what was advertised? You think we have to be really careful what we encourage women to look at. We're so vulnerable. We have not just the brain fog, we have the lack of self-confidence. We can be quite desperate to hang on to our relationships. And we're prepared to reach out to anything for some of us to survive. And I was one of the women who couldn't leave a house, who contemplated suicide, but knew I wouldn't because of personal family history and I have a daughter, but still thinking, how am I going to live for an extra 35, 40 years? Probably because I'm fairly healthy, sitting in my living room and crying in the corner of the kitchen and not being able to work from the office. And I think a lot of that when I put things together, because we can't just say flax seeds are going to sort everything out. We have to bring a lot more to the table for each person and their preferences.
And I think, again, going back to your presentation, the fact that if you do want to dig in a little deeper to one aspect of it, you've got that evidence, you know, you take them through to that place. And also, obviously, it's up to anyone to make those own choices that suit themselves, things they can. Some people will latch on to a particular nutritional pathway and they'll make the time and effort in their life to adjust that, and that will help them. And other people, it's like, well, I'm never going to do that, you know, so, but here's another QR code you could scan of something else that might help you. So it's great. Now, I want to talk a little bit about some of the women that were in the room there, because I think, and obviously, you know, you get a room of 16 people and some of them aren't going to say anything, some of them are going to say a lot, but we had a good range of people who kind of covered off the menopause spectrum a little bit. And I want to just talk about a couple of those women. So there was a woman there who had menopaused fairly early. Her peri-symptoms had started in her 30s, and she was going to the doctor at sort of around 40 or just before 40 and really struggling to get that sort of attention and acknowledgement. Is that quite a common thing where you see women now who are maybe slightly under the age, but the medical profession just aren't seeing that that's the menopausal age?
It's not even a common theme. It's constant. you know what, you have those light bulb moments that you see in people's eyes, and they go, oh my goodness, maybe that's why at that time I was only 38, I was only 33, I was only 36. There is a strong misconception because of the flipping term of menopause. The term menopause is the wrong term. It's one day in a woman's life, whereas perimenopause is between 7 and 12 years. So, you know, that one day at 45, it's completely normal around 33 to see things changing. And therefore, a lot of the women who come, yes, do end up going, my goodness, that's what happened to me at that time. I can join the dots now. I can remember something had changed and I couldn't really work out what it was. And it's usually way earlier than 45, yes. Mm. So the medical profession, by not using, you know, you heard me say that term several times, hypogonadism. I really, really wish we would be, as a gender, as a sex, taken on board and cared for something that is a hormonal deficiency. Because I think then we would be supported not just with the hormonal options, but strongly with the lifestyle options, just like someone is in a either hypothyroidism or a type 2 diabetes or type 1 diabetes. Here are the things that will make you survive longer for better and live well medically, plus all the suite of lifestyle options. That is, you know, it's really holistic. And in that, there is so much to suit whatever somebody is more passionate about. I've reflected a lot, and I think I shared that at the event. I don't know if you were still there, about my mother and realizing that she started her perimenopause in her early 30s. I remember my father talking about her weight. And that stigmatized me as a teenager, actually.
And well, you are French, Aline, though. You are all gorgeous goddesses, you know. That is the standard, you know. I'm not cutting your dad any slack for talking about your mum's weight, because that's bang out of order. But, you know, the French woman is the kind of gorgeous style.
Oh, thank you.
Fantastic figure icon, you know. So
thank you. But you see, my mum was never fat. She became a little bit more curvy. But what's really shocked me, which I only really realized in the past year and a half, is there was an episode when I was 16 and she was 36, where she lost the plot, complete menopausal losing the plot, angry, couldn't sleep, irritable, no help whatsoever. And she was actually postmenopausal early 40s. Mm. She never had any help. And that is still happening to women today. Because I do get women who come and say, I've been sectioned.
Wow.
And I'm talking with public health at the moment around Solihull and Birmingham. And that's something one of the partners there remembers quite strongly and shares pretty much every time we have a meeting, which is, I've seen those women in Aline's talk say, I've been sectioned for what was only extreme perimenopause symptoms.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, you can hear it in my voice. It's just really sad. It's
really sad. And going back to, you know, the woman who is in your talk, who her symptoms started in her 30s, her and many other women, even if they don't, their symptoms don't start early, so often the penny only drops when it becomes so catastrophically difficult that, you know, there are interventions. So yeah. I think those lost years are so awful, you know. And for some women, you know, it can end in lost life, you know, or, you know, like you say, being sectioned. I mean, just awful experience.
It's so extreme. And even if it doesn't get it that extreme, it's that it's the trusting of yourself and your own understanding of your own body. Because we know, just like we know as a mother when there's something wrong with our children, we know as a human being that something is not right, and not to be believed and to look to people we respect for their incredible medical knowledge, and to doubt ourselves because we trust the medical professional in front of us, to hear it's only when your periods change or stop, it's only when you're a certain age. That's complete bollocks, because we're all different. It's as if we were going to say puberty only starts at 11 years and 3 months and 2 days. Yeah.
Let's talk about Jeanette. Let's meet Jeanette. So Jeanette was one of the women at your talk, and she was postmenopausal because she'd had a hysterectomy a year before. But her journey to get to that hysterectomy was just unfathomable.
I sought help from 2011 onwards. I was having 2 periods a month. They only stopped when I had full surgery, total hysterectomy with ovaries, last June, so a year ago. Last weekend, actually.
And how old were you then?
57.
And what were the doctors saying to you when you were having these long and heavy periods?
Well, they finally, it took a long while to be understood and to listen to. And at first they were like, well, you're perimenopausal. This stuff happens. And I'm like, yeah, but I'm in agony. Surely it shouldn't be this bad. And I'd given up my role as an assistant head teacher because I would find that the first day of my period, just couldn't move, get out of bed, cope at all.
Wow, and so you basically struggled until 57 and they were incredulous that you were still having periods, right?
Incredulous, and people were saying, well, are you sure? And I'm like, yeah, I've been having them since I was 11. Much of the issues were that I'm overweight and people were telling me you can't possibly have surgery anyway, you're too overweight, you need to lose weight and come back when you've lost weight. And I was like, but I'm really struggling to lose weight and I'm not sleeping and I'm having 2 periods a month, which is agony. And I would literally be crawling around on my hands and knees and in excruciating pain. Alongside that, I was having these terrible bowel symptoms. So I was basically going down two routes, the bowel side of things and the gynae side of things. And I kept saying to both, they're linked. My bowel problems are around my periods and around my ovulation. I've been plotting it for 10 years. 2019, I had an MRI, finally, because I was told, obviously, they can't see endometriosis on an ultrasound and that it might be that. But I'm nearly menopausal, so don't worry about it. It's going to end soon.
They must have all been crossing their fingers you were just going to have your last period.
Well, that's what they thought. And then I was meant to have the hysteroscopy, and it was February 2020. I had the pre-op and everything, and then COVID hit. So that was cancelled. I then went to Scotland for a couple of years and lived in the wilds of the Isle of Arran. And
was that a symptom that of your
desperation,
menopause as well?
Yes. Desperation. And up there I saw a GP who, again, was like, you're probably perimenopausal, try the coil. It didn't stop my periods, unfortunately. She then tried Decapeptyl. That also didn't stop my periods. So then I was on the coil and Decapeptyl, which is a 3-monthly injection. By this time, I really was suicidal and still didn't stop my periods, still having 2 a month. This just got worse and worse and worse, and I constantly just felt that nobody was listening. And the older I got, the worse it got, because they were like, well, you're definitely going to be menopausal soon. And it got to the point, my eldest daughter was getting married last August, and I wanted to walk her up the aisle. And at this point, I could barely walk. And the pain, sciatica pain, and it turned out, when I did finally have surgery, that my womb was attached to my bowel. And I had a whole host of stuff going on with adhesions and endometriosis and adenomyosis. My womb was a couple of times bigger than it should have been. And no wonder I had all these symptoms.
Yeah.
And I took myself off and had private surgery in the end, because I'd seen an NHS specialist just before I went off to Romania, actually, for surgery.
So you had to go to Romania
to have an amazing clinic, an endometriosis clinic. And I went over there a year ago. I went there on the Tuesday, and on the Thursday I went in for surgery. And on the Friday I recovered, and on the Monday I walked out of the hospital. And I walked for the first time in months.
Wow.
I was able to walk.
So feeling much, much better.
Much, much better, but medically menopausal now.
Yes.
And now
struggling with that
because struggling to get help and get GPs to understand that I'm still concerned about the endometriosis still possibly being there and whether the estrogen will impact that. And so I've been kind of managing it alone, really, but doing so much better than before.
If you're listening to this and you haven't yet reached perimenopause or menopause, this is quite an extreme story.
Yes, we need to say that. And actually, it'd be quite nice to do that as a positive and say the majority of us have a lot less symptoms.
But listening to that, her whole life for 11 years was completely sort of thwarted. And as well as just having the kind of impediment of, you know, those 2 periods a month, you know, having to give up work, having to be in bed, being in pain, there's also the terrible worry of what is happening to me. And to have the medical professionals just keep saying, well, your period's got to stop soon, you know, you're 57, they're going to stop soon, they'll just stop, we'll just wait for them to stop, why don't we wait for them to stop, they're going to stop soon. I mean, That's bonkers, isn't it?
It doesn't make any sense. It's as if it just doesn't, the life of the individual doesn't matter.
Mm.
Whereas actually that person's been going on for years and years and years with their life on hold, in effect, or not living. Mm. And it doesn't matter just about the period. What else is going on? And that the fact that question isn't asked in her story, you think, are they missing the point?
Yeah. She's trying to put the two things together, the bowel stuff and the, you know, yeah. and the hormonal stuff. And then, of course, endometriosis. Why is that not taken more seriously? Neither of us are experts, but we've gleaned some experience. And if you have endometriosis, often your menopause journey, your perimenopause, you know, it's all exacerbated. It's all made so much worse. But there are also women, you know, who literally from their first period are struggling, you know, and that endometriosis is building. It affects fertility. It has women off work sick. I mean, it's just, you know, it's just not being investigated enough, is it?
I agree. And when you think that it's around at least 10% of women who are affected with endometriosis, and that is on what we see and acknowledge, because many of us don't complain about our periods because it is, we are brainwashed at a young age to, well, you're going to suffer. You just put up with it, and it's your bane for the rest of your life because you're a woman. Oh, and then you'll be lucky. You'll have your one menopause day, and then everything will be fantastic. You won't have period pains anymore. But really, endometriosis is a very large proportion of the population. 10% of women, that's 5% of the population. That's a lot of bodies. That's a lot of cost to the NHS. Mm. That's a lot of cost to employers. That's a lot of cost to the economy and to society. Mm. And if we are going to be driven by cost, which is to a large extent the world we live in, then I would think sorting something like this as a condition would bring a lot of benefits. Mm. If you look at diabetes, it's not that much higher percentage so of the population, and it's definitely a lot less than menopause. It's about 15-17% of the population, if that, 10% with diabetes 1 or 2, 51% for menopause. Yeah. And over 10% for endometriosis. Where is the balance there? I agree.
The other thing I want to talk about is one of the other women in your talk was a woman who had recently been diagnosed as having ADHD a year before, and literally the week before your talk, also autism. I want to talk menopause and neurodiversity. And I was really pleased to see that you have an actual pamphlet, leaflet, handout. That's the word, handout. Isn't it horrible having brain fog, Aline? I feel sometimes it takes four menopausal women to string a proper sentence together.
But how many of us to change a light bulb? Let's exactly.
We'd still be all right with a light bulb. We'd have the light bulb. We'd have the light bulb done while we're trying to remember the words. So you do a handout on neurodiversity. And you know, as you say, you're not a medical professional. You're definitely not a neurologist. But there is a link that's very poorly researched as far as I can work out, but I've lost count of the amount of women who've been diagnosed with ADHD or autism or something in their 40s or 50s. I think often the flux of menopause sends you looking for answers, you know, the mental and emotional impact will send you looking for answers. So it might be just that you get diagnosed then because you're searching for answers.
Yeah, no, to some extent. However, the person who helped me with those few slides is Sarah Mehag, and she's quite a specialist in all of this now because she herself has been supporting people with neurodiversity in her professional capacity, only to be diagnosed last year.
Amazing.
As neurodiverse. So now she can understand why. But she contacted me specifically because as a coach, as a well-being coach and physical activity coach, she was realizing more and more of the people she saw were women in their 40s coming with low self-confidence and really struggling to remain active. And she started putting those two together, thinking, that's got something to do with that perimenopause thing. And from there, even before she was diagnosed as neurodiverse, she came out with that conversation, of which you will actually find there's more and more online and forums and podcasts around, women are amazing at masking.
Mm.
And that's partly estrogen driven. You know, estrogen is a very nurturing hormone, to put it in a holistic fashion. Very nurturing. It's what helps us nurture the world, give birth to the world, give up ourselves to a large extent to be creative, whether through work or through children. And that hormone also makes us put ourselves second and last. And therefore, we find coping mechanisms when something isn't quite right. Mm. We cope as best we can during our puberty, during our adult life, and then perimenopause starts, and all those subconscious mechanisms that we've got in place and coping strategies, they go haywire because our other hormones have stopped supporting us, and therefore we can't mask so well. And I think that is when some women just topple over, and reaching to alcohol is quite common with people with neurodiversity who haven't been diagnosed, from what I'm reading. And now there seem to be more women, because there's a lot with social media and everything else. That's one of the powers of the web, who do find some answers, but then want to explore that it's not just Mrs. Goo on Google going, oh, yes, I've got the phone, you know, answer for you. And the problem is, it's what, 18 months, 2 years, 3 years before people can be diagnosed through the NHS? Yeah. And the other reason why women end up in that situation is, again, gender health gap. Here comes Sarah Graham. The approach to neurodiversity is based on the male symptoms of neurodiversity spectrums. And it doesn't take into consideration that female spectrums and female behaviors are not systematically the same in a neurodiversity situation as men. And actually, as we can see through observational studies, or for me, just my experience with my friends and the people I know come to talks, it's not at all the same, indeed.
No.
So women are not diagnosed younger because they're being measured against a scale which is male hormone driven. And when I say hormone, I don't specifically mean testosterone. I mean, let's say male biology driven.
Yeah. Yeah.
So those two aspects, women masks and women are not diagnosed, that blows up at perimenopause time. Plus, not that many of us actually survived their perimenopause until 150 years ago or were working. You add the layer of working into peri and postmenopause. How can you have your coping strategies work when there's a lot of what should be working in your body that is under threat because of imbalances and deficiencies? You know, we're sounding quite negative about the whole topic, because it's not a negative topic. It is also about empowerment, with understanding before it starts what to look for, understanding before it starts what are the right lifestyle for each one of us individually to help us thrive. Because we're much more likely to thrive into peri and postmenopause if we know what to do before it hits us. And that's another game.
I'm glad you mentioned the positivity, because it's in my notes actually to mention that, because you are very positive. And quite early on in your talk, you know, in the little quizzing thing, you know, you ask, what are the positives of menopause? And obviously people say the cessation of periods, which for a lot of people in the room hasn't happened yet, because they're perimenopausal. They're like, what? When's this going to happen? You know, this is
Could
the golden
tomorrow,
nugget.
Please?
Can we have it now, please? And then for a lot of us in the room, you know, I mean, I was just thinking about this just yesterday. I don't know what happened before Marina coils, because that has been, you know, I never thought I'd have a coil. I would never wanted one, but I was so desperate, and it's absolute lifesaver for the last 5 years. I've got to have it out in November, which I'm dreading, but, you know, I'll probably do a whole episode on that. But apart from the cessation of periods, you know, there are lots of positives,
yes,
aren't there?
Are.
And I do think that it is this time of great change. And just going back to Jeanette and her horrendous story, in the middle of all that awful time, she went off to the Isle of Arran for 2 years to do wild swimming and try and switch off. You know, she tried to find an answer for herself. You know, it wasn't the answer. It was, you know, I'm sure she had a jolly good time, but it wasn't the answer, because she needed a hysterectomy. You know, that was the answer. But she went off and did that. And I think the other thing about menopause that's really important is it is an opportunity for us to take on some challenges. And I know menopause is challenging enough. And if you can't get out of bed or put your pants on or have a shower because you feel so awful, then you don't want to say, I'm going to take on a challenge. But actually, just going fuck it and throwing it all up in the air, if you're in a position to do it, when else in our life can we do that? You know, it seems like the perfect time to go, fuck this shit, I'm gonna retrain to be a dog groomer and I'm gonna go and live in a caravan. You know, I mean, you can do what you like, can't you?
You've been watching The Change, haven't you?
I did actually watch the first episode, but only recently have I realized that at 51, well, in my late 40s, I had an MA and a PhD, which I don't really know why I did it, didn't need it, hated the PhD, halfway through wanted to give it up. And then the day after I handed my PhD in, I went off around Europe for 2 months on my own and wild camped and walked around an island. And at the time, I didn't realise that I was probably having a Perry moment. And it was brilliant. I loved it, you know. So yeah. It is a positive time.
It is a positive time, and it doesn't have to be completely drastic. It's also about, you know, that estrogen that is going is making us less caring maybe for everybody else, but is giving us that fuck it attitude. And I'll be wearing purple if I want to, dear. Thank you very much. And you remember that book that I showed, the black one? That's how to learn to say no to the rest of the world, but yes to yourself. And finding your tribes, whether it's through wild river swimming, says the woman who's doing it as well,
yeah.
Whether it's through crochet, whether it's through campaigning for a cause, whether it's through changing your career, whether it's through living in a camper van. I actually, out of necessity to some extent, after I accepted redundancy, I sold my house because I was bored, sort of thing. So I sold my house, moved into a house with two guys, and moved into my camper van because there was too much testosterone floating around. Bought another house, and 6 months later, I made that CIC, and it's immensely empowering to, you know, somebody like me who's not especially, was quite conservative in terms of risk.
Yeah.
Suddenly to go, well, no, I'm going to try that. I'm going to take that risk, and that's partly what I'm doing with Menopause Knowledge. It's wanting to do that full time for a start. And that can be really empowering. Whatever ticks our box, whatever we realize we're passionate about, we create our new tribes, our new adventures. It's fantastic. It doesn't have to be extreme. If it is extreme, that's great. But knowing we feel more empowered to do that because we care more for ourselves and we give less shit about others, it's fantastic. And that's definitely one of the positives. Yes, I feel it is, you know.
Yes, I agree. I couldn't agree more. And just sort of thinking about it, as I have been in the last couple of weeks, we had Jenny Haskey, the CEO of the Menopause Charity, on, and she was talking about women like rowing the Atlantic, and you don't have to row the Atlantic. But just thinking about that and thinking about challenges again, I'm like, actually, I think I need a challenge. I think sometimes you need a challenge, you know. We're running out of time, and it's been just a wonderful runaway chat. We could go on for hours. Very briefly, the last thing I wanted to talk about was testosterone, because on Saturday you had a fantastic T-shirt with testosterone, not just for boys, emblazoned across your beautiful bosoms. And I love that. But you had a great fact about testosterone, and I can't remember it. And when I was looking through your handout, I couldn't find it. But did you say, correct me if I'm wrong, menopause brain, did you say that our ovaries produce 4 times as much testosterone as they do estrogen?
They produce 3 times more testosterone than estrogen.
That's bonkers.
It's bonkers. It's obviously far from being as much as what men produce.
Yes.
And they also have a bit of estrogen, but you know, it's only a tiny bit, just like we only have compared to them a tiny bit of testosterone. But our ovaries produce 3 times more testosterone than estrogen, than estradiol.
And we can't get testosterone unless we have problems with our libido or we go private. I mean, this season we've talked about testosterone. We began with Kate Muir, who is absolutely on the testosterone warpath, and so she should be. And I didn't know that fact. I mean, Kate told me some great things about testosterone, but that one, well, she might have told me that and I've forgotten it because I got brain fog. But that just blew me away when you said that on Saturday. And so I really think this is one of the missing pieces, because there are so many pieces missing in this puzzle.
Yeah, and it helps us understand that we are more complex than we thought. And for me, I mean, that's very judgmental, I suppose. But if I'm in front of a medical professional who goes, well, women, testosterone, no, that's it. I'm switched off. Because if that basic biological fact is not known, how can you truly support someone presenting as a female when you don't even realize the importance of a critical hormone in their body? And it doesn't mean the person is to be doubted, is to be discarded. It just means there's that lack of education in our medical professionals, which explains why a lot of the women in my talks say, oh, well, that GP said this, that GP said that, that GP said I'm wrong, that GP said I'm too young, that GP, because they're missing pieces of the jigsaw puzzle, really.
Aline, it's been fantastic. It was great to see you in action on Saturday.
Thank you.
Menopause Knowledge, please go and find Aline. She's all over the social media. You've got a website as well.
Yes, and Menopause Knowledge. We're keeping it simple. We used to be called something else, and a few weeks ago we changed our name because it was really blurring the message. So Menopause Knowledge is much simpler.
Yeah. And it is an absolute wealth of information and support, and you're doing some great work, Aline. So it was a pleasure to see you in action, and I look forward to seeing how this grows and flourishes along with you growing and flourishing as well.
Thank you so much, Rachel, and I look forward to seeing you again soon.
Thanks again to Aline Boblin. And on next week's episode, I'll be talking to the government's first menopause employment champion, Helen Tomlinson. You can follow On My Last Eggs with new episodes released every Wednesday from Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Have a great week.